God, I thank you. I thank you for the privilege to come back home to my family, the family in this body. I thank you that they're for the truth of your family, that it isn't, there's no hesitation or regret of coming home a day early for the weekend. It's wanting to be here with the rest of my family. And I thank you for that. I thank you that you want to teach us. I thank you that you want to be a father to us all. I thank you that you want to remind us what you are and who you are and teach us who you are and what your character is. God, please do that today. Teach us more of who you are. Because you're a dad that character is perfect. Your love is perfect. We need to learn from you. Thank you, Jesus, that your name is above all names. Thank you that you give us the privilege and honor of being able to have a relationship with God the Father. Amen. So yeah, so I would say it was a crazy week and then a blessed few days. So today we're going to keep it pretty simple. We're in 1 Samuel 23. 1 Samuel 24. And David was still running from Saul. I hope you guys can, you know, God gave us the descriptions and the pictures and all the specifics of it for a reason. It wasn't just like he was bored inspiring people what to write down. God was very purposeful in giving us the things, and if God gives us the character descriptions and the geographic descriptions and the situational descriptions, then there's a reason for it. And we should look at it and try to put ourselves there. You know, we all have read books where we got absorbed or watched movies where you get absorbed or whatever. I mean, the Bible's one of those that it's valid and it's right to get absorbed and get absorbed in the details of what God says. Try to put yourself there and try to picture it and try to look at it. So here's David and he's running. You know, remember we left off where Saul was, here's Saul and all his men are chasing David around the mountain and his men and they're running and I mean they had to be right there. I mean we're talking running and Saul's going to kill him. He'd already shown to kill him, willing to kill him. And all of a sudden Saul gets a message that the Philistines are attacking somebody there and he quits and up and leaves and goes 20 miles north or whatever, 30 miles north. And, you know, I mean, can you imagine being those boys and sitting down and going, you know, can you believe that? I mean, God worked through the Philistines again to do it, you know, sent the Philistines to attack him right there at that moment. And so they laughed at David's kind of sigh of relief and God, what are you teaching us? And so here they are. So here's Saul. He gathers up a bunch of men, bunch of the best, choicest men in the nation, goes after David again to kill him. And they see him coming, I'm sure. Know he's coming and they went and hid in a cave. You need to picture this cave a little bit because I think it's, that's important as we read it to do it, you know. I mean, there's a few things about it that are fairly extraordinary to me. Is one is, even though I'd like to identify with David, I'm not a spelunker. Okay? I mean, going into dark caves, man, is not my idea of a good time. Now, I understand the sun might do it, but I think of the desert out there, and there was scorpions and vipers and skunks and all kinds of stuff. And the EverReady batteries probably weren't working real well. You know, and they're pretty stealthful and they're going in there and this cave had to be pretty big. I don't know how many of David's men were with him, but think of this. He had 600 men with him. I don't think they were all in there. I mean, this wasn't, I don't think it was Carlsbad's cavern, you know, what's that? Ice caves, you know, or something. I don't know how big this cave was. You would think that if it was that big, and obviously that big, Saul would have had his men go in and check it out. Who they are, or where they are, or whatever. Cave would be a good place to be on a hot day. There's no doubt about it in the desert. It would be a good place to be. So that's where we find ourselves. David running from again. In chapter 24, it says, Now it came about when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. So he's told David was in the wilderness. He moved from there. Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepfolds on the way where there was a cave, and David went in to relieve himself. And Saul went in to relieve himself. Remember, we talked about this country was a country within about 20 miles of Bethlehem. And it's where David grew up, getting to know God, raising sheep, being a shepherd. It's where he ran his sheep, all over the hills down there. And so David was probably pretty familiar with these caves and these hills. They knew where they could get in, where they could find refuge. Who knows exactly what the layout was, but. And Saul went in to relieve himself. Relieving himself doesn't mean he had to use the restroom. Relieving himself means that he basically put his feet up and got off his feet. And now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. Here's your enemy. They have 3,000 men, okay? And you've got 600 men. I don't know how many got with me. I can't believe all 600 were in that cave at once. Maybe. But I don't get that impression. I don't know. But that's a bunch of people in there. And the men of David said to him, behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I am about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you. Remember, these men knew who David was. David was this valiant warrior. He'd been leading the army of Israel for years prior to this. I don't know how long, but for years anyway. He was a commander-in-chief of the royal guard. David was he was known for being a warrior, and he had these guys with him. And when David came to enemies, David would get it done, doing it, and had no hesitation. There's a good chance some of these men, some of them were rabble-rousers and troublemakers, but I've got to believe that some of these men certainly knew about, had friends that were, brothers that were, or were there present when David went out and got his dowry for his wife, remember? 200 foreskins from Philistines, and they watched David go out and get that done. And I'm sure that, again, they weren't giving up willfully. David, in a matter of a few days or something, killed 200 men by himself. They'd seen him kill Goliath. They'd heard of him kill Goliath. The whole region had heard. All the Philistines, everybody had heard about David going after Goliath. They knew David was not afraid. Now, here you are in this dark cave. We don't know if there was many ways out. My guess would be there wasn't another way out, or they might have gone out the other way or something. But you're in this cave, and here's Saul and his men and 3,000 guys. That's 5-1. That's not very good odds. And they're outside, got your way blocked out, and you're inside. And what are these guys thinking? Picture yourself there. This is a dark, kind of potentially really scary place. His buddies say to him, this Saul and all these guys have been chasing around trying to kill us. Few weeks ago, they were chasing around the mountain. We're just about to be killed. And they said to him, go, do what's good, seems good to you. Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. Think about that for a minute. Moving around in a cave where it's completely dark, where there's rocks on the ground or there's whatever, things are pretty quiet. There wasn't a lot of white noise going on and whatnot, okay? And he's going to crawl in on Saul and cut a piece off his robe. That's one BA dude, okay? David, he didn't send one of his guys. What happens when Saul goes, hey, what are you doing? Who are you? What's going to happen? I'm sure Saul wasn't alone. How about if you just, you go to cut his thing? I mean, you're tugging on his robe? Cutting it with your, you know, if you had one of Buck's knives, it'd cut off real easy. You wouldn't have to worry, you know, otherwise, the risk. I mean, David knew the risk. I mean, you're going, God is with me, okay? But all of us would say that, right? When we go to do something, oh, God's with me. And then how do we act? Scared, chicken reluctant, fearful, all kinds of things. David went himself, crawled. I mean, I'm sure that they weren't, when Saul laid down, they weren't right there. So he had to work his way through it. What if you were laying there sleeping, even sleeping in the cave, and you heard something crawling towards you? I mean, I know I wake up at night when I hear any movement in my house. You know, it's just I'm awake. What was that? Right? I mean, and here you are in a dark cave, and out of the recesses of this cave, you hear something crawling. That's probably, you're probably not going to go, oh, don't worry about it. Go back to sleep. Right? I mean, the situation here is like, I mean, David, for him to crawl out, cut off a piece of his robe, and then crawl back to where he was, hiding in this cave. You know, I don't know if it gets any tougher than that. It was dark. I'm sure it was pretty stinking dark. And how about if one of the guys with Saul wasn't asleep? And how about if the guys whose guards laying next to him wasn't asleep? And they see something crawling on his belly out of the cave doing it. I mean, this is real. You know, this isn't some pretend little cute Sunday school story. I mean, this is real that he's crawling out of there doing it. And David went and did this, okay? I mean, when I think of it, I think, oh, man. It doesn't say anything about it. It doesn't say anything about what they'd done except that he went and did it. So he rose and he cut off the edge of his robe secretly. And it came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. Now, I think, you know, there's a side of it where, oh, you ruined his clothes. I don't really think that's what he's talking about, okay? You know, you cut off a corner of his robe. Now, you know, it was a little tougher. He couldn't necessarily go to, you know, wherever and get some more clothes. But I don't think that's what it was, okay? I think what it was is he knew darn well if things got turned Western, somebody's dying. You know, he crawled in there and put himself and all the people in there. If all of a sudden somebody went, hey, what are you doing? Somebody's dying. And you're in a cave. And you know, would he have to kill Saul? Saul would have tried to kill him. That's what he was there for. He would have tried to kill him. And David realized, what did I just do? He was incredibly humble. There's no doubt. David was a humble, he was not proud. You know, David, the thing to me, David honored and he respected, Saul as his king, as his anointed king, as his father. He addresses him in a minute as his father-in-law. He was his father-in-law. And he just put himself in a position that if somebody woke up, if somebody felt a little tug, I mean, think of that. You're sleeping there in the middle of a cave and you feel a little tug on your clothes. You know, you're going to wake up because you're going to think, is this a badger or what's in here biting on me doing? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just my paranoia caves or something, you know, that makes me think that would be a creepy place to be, you know, on doing it. But David had just put himself in a position to have to kill Saul, if necessary, and kill Saul's guys around him. Was he scared? David didn't seem to be scared here. I mean, he didn't say, hey, why don't one of you guys go cut his edge of his robe off or something, you know? David went in and did it himself. So he said to his men, far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord. His Lord, meaning that he was calling Saul his master. He was calling Saul his master. The Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed. And David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. His men are going, come on, we got him right here. We can get this done. They knew David had been anointed to be king, right? So think of this. When you think of these guys that are with you, and David has been anointed by Samuel to be the king, Saul had been anointed by Samuel to be the existing king. If Saul dies, David's king, right? So here's all these guys, 600 guys with him, thinking, you kill Saul, we're done. Now you're the king, and we're your guys. Which they ended up being a little bit later. They ended up being his men. They ended up being his valiant warriors, his protectors, his bodyguard, his mighty men on doing it. And they're going, man, you know, let's get this done right now. We're running around out here hiding in caves. This is not a good thing. Let's get this done right here. And David said, nope. He said, I will not allow you to. You persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose, left the cave, and went on his way. Now, afterwards, David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul. He couldn't have gotten too far away, right? Couldn't have gotten too far away, saying, my lord the king. And when Saul looked at him, David bowed his face to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men, saying, behold, David seeks to harm you. Behold, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord had given you into my hand in the cave. And some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you. And I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Now, my father, see, look, wake up, rub your eyes, let the sun shine in. Indeed, see the edge of your robe in my hand? For in that I cut off the edge of your robe and did not kill you, know and perceive that there is no evil or rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you, since you are lying in wait for my life to take it. The thing that I feel today needs to say about, this is David exhibiting agape love. This is David exhibiting love that God has called us all to exhibit, okay? This is the Old Testament. What do you mean the word agape didn't exist? God's love existed, okay? And what God called David to, really, God is God, we are men. Their things haven't changed as much as we'd like to think sometimes, okay? David was exhibiting agape love. He was exhibiting selfish love, and this is what it looks like. One thing agape love never is passive. And David was exhibiting agape love, and all of us should be reminded of what that looked like, and that's where I think we should go today, and looking at 1 Corinthians 13. Let's finish reading what he says here, because this is David. What does the Bible say to your enemies, to do to your enemies? To love your enemies. Now, I struggle with it too, you know. So, somebody does something wrong to me, somebody offends me, somebody comes in and steals my campsite, you know. Somebody does something and I have a hard time being patient and kind and gentle and long-suffering and not considering a wrong done against myself or my sons or whatever. It's something that we all should be reminded of. Here is David's enemy. David has every right. He's been anointed king. Saul is acting brutally wrong. Saul is acting completely wrong. God has rejected him as king. He's pulled his spirit from him. David knows full well he's pulled his spirit from him, right? David has seen the evil spirit from God that God has allowed to torment Saul, control him, and try to kill him, pin him to wall with a spear, his own father-in-law. David knows this. God has pulled his blessing from Saul. And yet David still loved his enemy. And it's something that, you know, obviously we cannot learn too well. We cannot see too well. What checks us? What is the thing that in our response to people? Is it self-defense? Is it self-protection? Is it self-promotion? Is it what we would consider fairness? Because something about agape love, you have to be very careful to try to say fairness is in play here. Okay? Because it's not about being fair. You know? Just like loving your children. It doesn't really have much to do with being fair. You know? It's not, I will serve you, I will change your diapers, I will take care of you, and as a result, I'll get back. Okay? There's a lot of thankless things that you love the way you love your children. In fact, you know, again, some of you heard me say this, but it was interesting to me because I grew up my whole life that agape love, because agape is a Greek word, but agape love, is very, New Testament defined. And there's really no way in Greek literature or anywhere else to define agape, the word agape. It was pretty much a useless word in the Greek language, you might say. But it's highly defined in the New Testament, what it means, what agape means. So, I think that for us to, I don't think it's any different in our culture than in that culture when Jesus was trying to teach them and God was trying to teach them what His love looked like, that we do not diminish our understanding to what our culture says. Again, you know, our culture defines love. I mean, one of the great tragedies of the 60s and 70s is love was written everywhere. You know, love, 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 peace, love. You know, free love, something. You know, love was put everywhere, and yet we define love as something so different than what agape love is. And it's really important for all of us to, because it's central. It says God is love. Right? God is love. That's a big statement. If God is something, it's not just part of His character. God, He absolutely epitomizes what is defined in the New Testament as agape love. That's what God is. That's who God is. That is His character and His nature. And it is expressed from the beginning of what we know till the end of what we know. And it's a radical thing. God says in order for us to have a right relationship with Him, we need to love God with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind, all our strength. That's His love. That's His kind of love that is defined as He says it. And it has nothing, very little to do in obedience with liking Him a whole lot. That doesn't mean we shouldn't like God. I'm not saying that. Don't get me wrong. But the commandment is not to like God really, really, really a lot. Okay? As we define love. We define love as what you really like, you kind of really, really like, and then you love. And love is meaning you really, really, really like. You know? And that is not the biblical definition of love. It has little to do with feelings. And God's love towards us is too. Now our feelings something that God created and our good feelings towards God something we should have? Yes. It never tells us in the Bible to phileo love God. And phileo love would be the Greek word for extreme feelings. Phileo love would be the word for best friends. Phileo love would be the word for an intimate, loving relationship like a family's supposed to have. Okay? Anything wrong with phileo love? No. In fact, we're commanded, God says, we're commanded to agape love and to pursue phileo love with each other. We're told to do that. We're told to become best friends. In this room, whether you like me or not, you're told to work on being my best friend, okay? So get after it, okay? You're told to work on being best friends. And yet, and the same thing with God. Does God want it to be a friend? I mean, I don't think there's a greater thing than you're a friend of God, you know? I mean, that's a powerful, radical thing. But that does not come. It doesn't come by, well, I like Him enough to call Him my friend. And now I really, really like Him a lot, so now I love Him. That is not the progression. In fact, the progression that God calls us to is to love first, to agape love first, to be selfless in our response towards Him, to regard Him as more important than ourselves. This is very much what David did, okay? This is very much what he did back then. I mean, he prostrated himself to the ground, okay? Put himself on the ground, bent over, and honored Him. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked come forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. Now, obviously, he'd repented for putting himself in a dangerous position. I mean, that's a tough one. You know, I understand my boys and I were talking this weekend, and as I was riding with them, and you know, it was something that God put on my heart to go riding, okay? And to take a couple days and go ride in the mountains. And we did some pretty extreme riding, you know, on big bikes. And we could have died a lot of times. Like, really fast. I mean, we were, you know, riding along the edge of Hell's Canyon and places that if you went off, you weren't going to be okay. You were going to die. Okay. You know, we were riding at speeds a lot of times that if a deer came out, you could do nothing about it. You know, you were going to die. And here I am as a dad. I mean, at times right going, what am I doing? I mean, there was one time when we're riding down the road and I'm being conservative. They're all going, Billy comes up to me and goes, Dad, what's the matter? Does that thing have a rev limiter or something? Come on, you know, let's go, you know? And Billy, it's not really fair because Billy's a really, really good rider, but he's riding this great big bike. He has 125 horse GS $27,000 bike that he's, you know, riding. He's going, come on, Dad, let's run. And I'm thinking, yeah, I really want to run. If I was by myself, I'd be running here, but I'm kind of being dad here and leading. And man, if one of you guys runs into a tree or something, what am I going to think? You know, what position have I put you in? You know, it's just my heart started to pound, you know, doing it. And they take off, you and Josiah take off. And I'm going, oh my gosh, man, we're going to go down this thing. As looking back, you're going, what did I create? I mean, if one of my kids got hurt, I mean, what did I do? You know, it's one of the reasons I sold. We had three mod 800 sleds that we'd ride in the mountains. It ran really well. And, you know, when I made sure I had the fastest one, just so I could stay ahead of my kids at the time. But we had three really good running sleds that we'd run in the mountains. And after I got buried by an avalanche, I got buried in a big avalanche. And after that, I'm thinking, I don't want to take my kids up here. You know, I mean, what happens if one of them gets buried? You know, doing. I mean, this feeling of, oh my gosh, what did I just do? That's the feeling David had when he says his conscience got to him. I just put myself in a position. If Saul had twitched, if I'd went in cutting his thing, if the knife had hung up a little and had yanked on his coat a little bit or something, and he woke up, what would I have had to do? I would have had to kill him. You know, I would have had to, you know, and I understand that feeling that you just went, oh my gosh, what did I just do? I just put myself in a position where things would have been, I would have regretted what happened and doing it. Now, my sons fortunately have common sense and must have got it from their mother and, you know, have a lot of talent. And so they didn't hurt themselves and didn't go crashing, and they were at the bottom of the hill fine, and I breathed a sigh of relief, you know. So they were good. So here's David now. He's going, so he went through that process, I think, in a very short period of time, obviously. I don't know how long he was in there taking a nap, Saul was, but in a short period of time. And I'm sure he said, God forgive me, because he said, what have I done? You know, I've put myself in a bad position. He said, God, I'm sorry. He comes out and apologizes to him for doing that. But he says, may the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge you. May the Lord avenge you, not me. I'm not going to put myself in a position where I avenge myself against you. But my hand shall not be against you. And the proverb said, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand will not be against you. I will not act wicked again. After whom has the king of Israel come out? This is David's humility. After whom are you pursuing? After a dead dog? After a single flea? The Lord, therefore, be judge and decide between you and me, and he see and plead my case and deliver me from your hand. Now it came about when David had finished speaking. What does the proverb say? A kind word turns away wrath. A grievous word stirred up anger. I mean, there's probably a lot of things David could have said when he came out of that cave. You know, there's a lot of names he could have called him to say, hey, so-and-so, do you realize I could have just killed you doing it? I mean, David could have been, but David was honorable. He did not put out a grievous word, right? He was kind. He was patient. He was respectful. He honored Saul in doing that. And as a result, what happened? When David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, is this your voice, my son David? Then Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, you are more righteous than I. For you have dealt well with me, and I have dealt wickedly with you. And you have declared this day that you have done good to me. And the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day. And listen to Saul. And now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. So now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's household. And David swore to Saul, and Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. A kind word turns away wrath, but a grievous word stirs up anger. That's so hard to see at the time, okay? All of us, you know, myself too, have been in the position where the right thing to do, the fair thing to do, the real thing to do is to speak truth here, to get in his face and go, what are you doing, idiot? Why are you doing this? Whatever. And David was kind, and David was respectful, and look what it did. It broke Saul for the moment. It broke Saul. And all of us, you know, I don't think there's any few things that are more important to us. God commands us. He says, the totality of the law, we can try to be good Christians. We can try to do the things that please God. We can try to, and I'm not saying it's wrong to try to please God, but we can try to do all kinds of other things besides humble ourselves before each other and regard others as more important than ourselves. That's like, right? And yet that's the first, okay? That is the number one. He says, in that, loving God with all your heart and all your soul, your mind, and loving your neighbor, it says it's yourself. That doesn't mean I look in the mirror and I like myself a lot, man, so I'm going to like you. You know? Because if that's what it meant, Moses would look in the mirror and go, I don't like myself very much, so guess what? Now I have an excuse not to like you. Okay? Because God says to love you like I like me, and I don't like me, so I don't like you either. So, I'm doing just like God told me to. That's not what he means. It doesn't mean liking myself a lot, and therefore I like you a lot in doing that. What it means is that I regard you. You know, the issue is when God tells us to love our wives. I mean, he gives us a good example of that in Ephesians 6. When God tells us to love our wives, he gives us the same thing, only it's a little bit more descriptive. Ephesians chapter 5, I'm sorry. He says, husband, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. Now that sounds all theological and whatnot. And he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So if your wife has any spots and wrinkles and isn't holy and blameless, it's your fault, husband. That's what he says. Your responsibility. Did she come as damaged goods? Sorry, girls. Yeah, you did. You had issues. Okay? But it's now your fault. Now it's your husband's responsibility. God says that we are to wash her in the water of the word. We are to take that responsibility and help her heal and help the things that we as fathers failed her in be transformed into a true understanding of God. And so, here we are. No excuse, guys. It isn't, well, she's like this. Okay? So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. Love their wives as they love their own bodies. Again, is that about looking in the mirror and going, oh yeah, dashing, aren't I? You know? So I guess I must love my wife like that. That is not what it means. He describes it here in a way that it gives us a description of agape love and what that should look like more than most places. He says, "For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church." Okay? What does that mean? That easily transfers into a 70s view of, you know, love too. But that is not what he says. Nourishing, cherishing. Cherishing, the word cherish doesn't mean that you polish it, treat it gently, and put it up on the mantle, right? That is not what cherish means. It's not like cherishing your 56 Chevy restored or your Mustang or something. It's not like cherishing in a way that we, what it means is to keep warm. That's what the word means. To keep warm. Okay? It's not this cute little put up on the mantle thing. It has nothing to do with that. Nourishing and cherishing. That means that he gives it substance and food, and that he keeps it warm. He knows the temperature of that body as your own flesh. Now, what we're commanded to do is love our wives that way. What does that mean? Do you have to tell me if I'm hungry? Do you have to tell me if I'm hot, if I'm cold? By the way, it's kind of hot in here. But do you have to tell me that, or do I know it inherently? So, the way God tells us to love men, to love their wives, and that's agape love, by the way. That's the way I'm supposed to love my brothers, and that's the way I'm supposed to love my enemies. What does that mean? That I am to know their hearts. That I am to minister to them without them having to tell me. That I'm not supposed to go, love is not walking up to somebody going, "Oh, anything I can do to help you?" Nope. Okay, good. I was hoping you'd say that. I'm done. See ya. Right? Love is not pretending. It's not saying, "Well, he didn't tell me he needed anything, so I guess I'm off the hook." I mean, we all want to do that sometimes, right? Oh, gee. Maybe they need something. "Well, do you need anything?" "No." "Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you don't. So I'm good." No, that's not what it means. It says that we are to care for them like we would our own body. In fact, we're to read their needs. We're to be intuitive. And that means as egghead men, which God didn't typically create us with intuitiveness, okay? That's not necessarily the stereotype on it. Does that give us an excuse? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But what God says there is that we are responsible to know the hearts of the people that God calls us to love. Just like David was responsible to know the heart of Saul. David honored him. He called him father. There's a lot of responses David could have had that wouldn't minister. But David agape loved Saul in the way that we are supposed to love our neighbors, in the way that we're supposed to love our wives, in the way that we're supposed to love our enemies. How do we do that? The Spirit of God. David had the Spirit of God that said, how do I love Saul? God said, this is how you love Saul. We as men have no excuse. If you're a fleshly man without the Spirit of God, well, you're an ignorant, selfish man then. Just the way it is. You aren't going to change that. Same thing with wives. You know, you can try to be nice. You can try to act nice. But we are dependent on the Spirit of God to read our children. We are dependent on the Spirit of God to read our husbands. We are dependent on the Spirit of God to read our friends, our brothers, our sisters, and our enemies. And minister to them and love them and regard them, meet their needs and love them. David did that. And the result, many have said, and I think it's true, there's nothing more powerful than love. There's no greater strength than love. There is no greater deterrent against attack and enemies than love. Now, I am not talking about passive. I am not talking about coward. You know, you cannot in any way go, you know, David did not go, "Phew, I didn't get killed." I mean, for David to go out and cut off a piece of Saul's robe in that cave was brave beyond imagination to me. You know, I mean, I would have been hiding going, "Don't move. Don't make a sound. Don't kick a rock." I mean, kick a little rock in the back of that cave and they hear something in the back of the rock, in the back of the cave. What are they going to do? And yet David was not afraid. David went all the way out there. He cut off a piece of his robe. But he realized the position he'd put himself in with Saul, that he'd have to take matters into his own hand, and then regret it when it was said and done. Okay? Let's finish 23. We did finish 23. Let's go to chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians and read that real quick, because there's some places in Scripture that we should have memorized, okay? And this isn't a suggestion. That's about as close to if you call yourself a person in pursuit of God, you should have this memorized, this chapter. Okay? That's awful demanding. Yeah, it is. And I'm saying that, okay? Anybody misunderstand that? Maybe some Sunday I'll... Oh, yeah. Remember the Ten Commandments? I was going to do it. You guys ready for that one? Who am I going to call on here? Okay. Who's going to do the Ten Commandments here? Let's hear them. But 1 Corinthians 13 is one of those that you should have memorized. It is a powerful passage of Scripture that will alter and change your life. See you guys. And 1 Corinthians 13 is the description of God's kind of love. Okay? Like I started to say before, I grew up thinking that agape love was something, I was taught this kind of, that it was a fruit of the Spirit, because it is, okay? If the Spirit of God is in you, it is something that will be produced from you, okay? It is a fruit. Fruit is something that's produced from a tree, from a vine, whatever. And if we have the Spirit of God inside of us, we will produce agape love on the outside, okay? What is agape love? What are you producing? If you don't know and can't define it and can't, as God defines it, we don't know that. I was told the only way you could do that is the Spirit of God in you. And that's, I think, for the most part, that is what it talks about. But there is a verse in Scripture that says, agape love is as the mother's love towards their child, towards their baby. That's selfless love. Okay? If you act correctly as a mother towards your child, it's a thankless. Does the baby give back to you? I mean, the minute the kid has gas and gets a little smile on his face and looks at you, you think, oh, good, finally a reward from doing what I'm doing, you know? I mean, cause you spent so much thankless time getting up at night and nursing and changing its diapers and trying to figure out why it's crying and what's the matter with it and just thankless. Tiring job, demanding job that doesn't give back. But you do it, right? As a mom. That's what you do, right? That's selfless love. Why do you do it? Because they tell you thank you? Because they give you a big hug and a kiss? No. You do it because you're a mother. And there's something about you that God made, if you're anywhere close to healthy, that makes you want to pour into that child and realize that that child is utterly dependent on your selflessness towards them. Okay? It's selfless love. It's not what you get back, it's selfless love. But this 1 Corinthians 13 defines it very concisely. Okay? And is one of those that we should be defined, because we can always use 1 Corinthians 13 to define very typically pretty vividly our response to someone. Okay? And if it's in our heart and we're memorized by it, you know, we often use the term, we use it against each other in marriage, right? I mean, so we would never do that. But we use it in marriage against each other. Was that the loving thing to do? Right? That wasn't a very loving thing to do. That wasn't very nice. And that's what we mean usually, is nice, okay? Because somewhere around in this definition, I don't see the word nice. You know, are we supposed to be, how are we supposed to be to each other? That means we're not supposed to be nice? Well, I'm not saying that. But nice is defined on how you make me feel. And understand very, very clearly that us loving somebody with agape love is not defined, if it's love, on how they respond. Okay? Nice is defined by, are they offended? Are they hurt? Are they troubled by it, or they don't like it, or they don't like me, or they say I'm mean? Okay? What little kid doesn't say his dad's mean when he puts him over his knee and spanks his butt the way he needs to do it? Okay? If he does it correctly, he will have a response of, he's mean. That'll be corrected, and that'll be turned, and he'll realize if it's done correctly, and he will be broken, and he will be contrite, and he will want to hug his dad, and he will trust his dad, and he will not fear his dad in a wrong way. That's true. Okay? But that mean, seems mean, doesn't necessarily define or not define love. Where being nice is. The other thing that you'd see in this 1 Corinthians 13 that you need to be, we need to be very careful of, is I don't see anything that gives any leeway for passivity. Okay? I would say that agape love is not passive. Okay? Agape, does that mean it's aggressive? I'm not saying that. It's not passive. Okay? It is an action word that means that we actively do something. And you say, well, you actively shut your mouth. Well, all of us understand that the vast majority of the time when we have to shut our mouth, it's a very active act, right? I mean, there's some times that when we shut our mouths because we're selfish and we're a coward and we don't want somebody to not like us. And we well, that is passive. That is selfish, okay? That's being passive. But being active and shutting your mouth because you, I don't know quite how it works, but somehow there is a direct string, a rope that goes to your mouth, and you reach around and grab this part of you, and you pull on it, and it makes your mouth shut, you know? So, really? Okay. All of us understand that closing our mouths is not an passive thing, right? That us being quiet, holding our tongue, is something that we have to work at doing, okay, at times. And what does that mean? That means not acting out in our flesh. That means, just like David, not doing what he felt like, right? All his men said, God has delivered him. This is the right thing to do. This is how you should act. And he goes, I'm not going to do how I feel. Okay? I'm not afraid. David wasn't using, oh, I don't think I should attack him. Thank you. I'm scared to go. David was not afraid to go get in the middle of it. He was not a passive man when it came to that. He had nothing to do. It was not about how he felt. It was about what was right. So I want you to understand this because I think it's important. 1 Corinthians 13, let's read through it quick. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, what does that mean? You know, that doesn't mean yakking with tongues necessarily or whatever, well, I don't want to go there at the moment. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. What that is taking the absolute extreme. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge. I mean, this is talking about all knowledge and all wisdom. It's talking about having eloquence and wisdom and prophetic utterance. It means knowing the intentions of your heart. That's what prophecy is knowing, revealing the intentions of men's heart. And I have all faith so as to remove mountains. That's a bunch of faith, right? The Bible says that. If you say this mountain, get up and move, it'll move, right? How many of us done that lately? What's the matter with us? You know? But that God says that if we are people of faith, that can happen. What he's doing is talking about the extremity. So you have real faith. You have real prophecy. You have real wisdom. You have a real slick tongue, or nice tongue, you might say, whatever it is. So as to move mountains, but do not have love, what? I am nothing. And if I had give all my possessions to feed the poor, all of them, and if I deliver my body to be burned, if I'm a martyr and do not have love, it profits me nothing. So, we just kind of took out all the excuses because it took the extremities here, right? Of saying, yeah, but I did this. Yeah, but I did that. Yeah, but this is what I felt. Or this is the way I think. Or this is... No. We don't get any excuses. It says that if we do not act in an agape loving way towards people, what we say to them, even if it's perfect wisdom, even if it's speaking truth, all of us have been faced with the position of, yeah, but it's truth, so if it's truth, I'm going to say it. Speaking truth without love is, it says you're a clanging, noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. How much of us would be positively affected if somebody came up behind us and with cymbals and went, bam, like that, right? What would that do to us? We turn around and want to punch him, right? We just, it'd startle us. It just make us mad doing it. It's the same thing. You might have perfect wisdom, he says. You might speak perfect truth. But if it is not done with love, it is destructive. It is absolutely counterproductive at best. Okay? And if I'm a martyr, if I'm sacrificial, if I give everything, but do not act in this way, it not only profits me, it profits them nothing. What is love? How did David act? How did David act towards Saul? And how are we to act? How are we to put this as the umbrella or the banner of to always look at and say, this needs to define my actions? Love is patient. That doesn't mean passive. It means patient. In fact, I would say patience most of the time, when exhibited correctly, is absolutely the opposite of passive. Patient is willingly submitting your will. Actively submitting your will. It's not being passive. It's not being afraid. It's not being selfish. It's willing. Love is kind. Love is not jealous. Love does not brag. And love is not arrogant. Love does not act unbecomingly. Doesn't throw hissy fits or tantrums or I'm just having a bad day or whatever. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked. If my response to you is out of being provoked, I'm wrong. You know, I certainly don't sit here without realizing I can be easily provoked at times. That is wrong. That's unloving in my response. Okay? It is not provoked. It does not take into account a wrong suffered. It does not take into account a wrong suffered. Now, that one in and of itself, if we just memorize that, it would really modify our behavior if we were willing to be submissive to it. Because all of us justify our responses and our actions and how we come to people and how we treat people and how we respond to people. Right? When we're wronged. When something wrongs us. When somebody is unjust. When somebody is unfair. When somebody isn't doing right. And again, my sons know I don't stand on higher ground here. Just about punched an old guy with a BMW this weekend. I'm sorry. Okay? So, I didn't, but so. But was I in the right? Yeah. Was he wrong? Yeah. Did he wrong? Yeah, he stole our campsite doing it. You know? But, fortunately, I finally got a hold of myself and did not punch him. So, it does not take, it's not recording, is it? It does not take into account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things positively. It endures all things. And guess what? Love never fails. There's not a, I get a day off, don't I? Or, I've been loving enough for a while, haven't I? If there are gifts of prophecy, they'll be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there's knowledge, it will be done away. And when we won't need no prophecy. You know, when we get to heaven, remember, some of you know that I've talked to you about, you know, what would it be like and what would our lives be like? And we should live our lives, but we don't. What if we all had a computer monitor that sat on top of us? You know, let's just say it was one of those, I don't know, what do you call it, where it's a something gram or something like that, heliogram or something.
Oh, hologram.
Hologram, yeah. Let's say it's a hologram, okay, so you don't have to carry this stuff in your head, okay? But just picture for a moment. There's a hologram screen on top of your head where all your thoughts are up. All your thoughts are there, scrolling across. Every thought you have in your brain goes across your hologram screen, okay? Yeah, all of you are going, right? You wouldn't want to be in public. You wouldn't want to do, but the truth is, that's really, I mean, we're sitting before God. Does he see that screen? He does. When we get to heaven, will that screen be there in effect? Yes. I'm confident it will be. There will be no hypocrisy. There will be no lying. Yeah? There will be no untruth. We will live in the light. And I believe that's part of what it means to walk in the light, not in darkness. Because what do all of us want to do? But where's the off button? Turn the off button off, right? I don't want this to be seen. Somebody might see this. Okay? We'll walk in the light. That's prophecy is revealing the hearts of men. That screen is one that reveals your hearts doing it. There'll come a day when we are in heaven where those things, that won't be necessary anymore, right? We won't need the gift of prophecy because you're going to have that screen hologram, however it affects yourself in the real world there, okay? They'll be done away. We won't need tongues because we'll understand each other. You know, knowledge, we'll know knowledge. We'll know everything. We'll walk in the light. For we know in part now, and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke, used to think as a child, speak as a child, reason as a child. But when I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now we know in part, but then we shall fully know, just as we've been fully known. But now abide faith, hope, and love. These three, but the greatest of these is love. Love is very important. It's not this cutesy little nice things. Aren't we supposed to be nice to each other? I hate most of church and religion. You have to excuse me. I hate it when people are nice to me. That doesn't mean I want people to be mean to me and not treat me right. But when people are nice because that's the nice social thing to do. Oh, hi, David. It's so good to see you. Shut up. You don't care. Excuse me. You know, doing it. I want real. Yeah, no, I want kindness. I want patience. I want living in that and being in that is true. You know, false flattery. You know, oh, it's so good to see you. Really? You know, where were you all week when I was getting my butt kicked? You know, the church is maybe one of the most hypocritical places. You know, that you can be. Everybody tries to be nice, okay? Now, it's patient, it's kind, it's long-suffering, okay? Does not take into account of wronging each other, regards you as more important than itself. Well, that's a nice environment, right? You don't get to be mean to me. You don't get to not regard me. You don't get to not care, okay? But it's about being real. It's about truly living in that, not pretending to be. Not pretending like, don't we all get along so good? It's about regarding others as more important than ourselves. David acted in love towards Saul, and what did it do to Saul? I mean, here's Saul. Gonna kill him. And Saul broke down, he cried. He says, my son, you know, I'm sorry, you have acted wisely. He made a radical statement, you're gonna be the king of Israel. You are going to establish the kingdom of Israel. That's why he's trying to kill him. I mean, this is old school Bedouin stuff, man. I mean, you not only go kill your person who might be a threat to you, but you kill all his family and all the offspring so there's no more threat. I mean, that's how you get her done. We didn't have a democratic system, you know, where you're making some votes doing it. I mean, you just go kill him and get it done. That's how you acted. And he says, you are going to be king. And I know that. Knowing his son Jonathan was there. And Jonathan was a worthy king. I mean, it's an amazing thing to me. Jonathan was absolutely worthy from everything we know about him of being king. Jonathan was a man after God's heart too. I regarded that way. But David's kind words turned away wrath. Our loving response to each other, and it's so hard to do. It's true of myself. It's so hard to do. A response to somebody that is regards them as more important than yourself, even when they are saying things that are very selfish and in the flesh. Watch what God will do. Watch what God will do. And all of us can learn a lesson in that. Or anybody here has that dial? You have that dial, Lisa? None of us do. Including myself, unfortunately. So, let's pray. God, I thank you that the Old Testament has picture stories of seeing your truth in work. David was led by your Spirit. David was not only anointed to be king, but he was anointed with your Spirit. The Spirit, you said your Spirit came on him powerfully. If the Spirit of God came on him powerfully, and he responded and acted in the empowerment of the Spirit of God, it is as us. The fruit of the Spirit was love. Agape love. God causes, please, to continue to work on. I know it'll be a lifelong pursuit in our culture to eradicate the enemy's purposeful wrong definition of love. And cause us to be willing to hear what you call us to. And that's your love. That's agape love. Cause us to realize that that can be an effect in the strongest and most tense and most ugly situations. In our homes, in our work, Copperfield Campground, wherever, cause us to be obedient to you in love. Is that, if we did that, it says that takes care of all the law and the prophets. That it's all encompassed there. And if we do that, if we fulfill that, we'll be right with you. Not by works, but by surrender and obedience. That love is dying to ourselves and regarding others is more important than ourselves. Dying to ourselves regarding you is more important than ourselves is what loving you is. Not liking you, not feeling good about you. Those aren't wrong. That's not what defines love. It causes us to realize that we need to be selfless in our response. That's what we're called to. And if we aren't, it's just an awareness of our flesh that needs to be killed. You're a good God, and I thank you for the story. It causes us to envision David coming out of that cave after Saul was starting down the hill or wherever it was. Realizing the boldness that took. That means he was in rock throwing distance or pretty close to be able to speak like that to 3,000 guys that were called there to kill him. And he came walking out of the cave. That was bold. Cause us to be that bold, God, in the face of our enemies. Cause us not to fear man, but to fear you and be obedient to you. You commanded David to love Saul, to honor him, to respect him. And he did those things. And he feared you and disobeying you more than he did his lone life and men. Cause us to be that way. I thank you that you have given us the power and the ability to have victory over sin through Jesus' death and resurrection. I thank you that you give us. You don't call us to something that we're not capable of. You call us to something you've given us everything necessary to do. Forgive us for our shortcoming and God, keep your boot in our fanny. Because you're a loving dad. Amen.